Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them.
Disrespect welcomes to the show the Civic Engagement Coordinator at The Stop Community Food Center in Toronto, Jonas Schein. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jeff.
Now, we're looking for an update on what happened in Hamilton prior to the holidays. You, or at least your group, visited Hamilton and engaged a number of people in the community, including a politician, on the subject of the adequacy of fixed incomes in your campaign, Do the Math, which is on the website of The Stop.
Right.
How'd it go?
It was, Jeff, it was really an amazing event, I think, on December 4th. I remember I wasn't feeling very well in the morning, so I was, just physically I wasn't feeling that great, but the energy from everybody who was involved, the passion there, it kept me going throughout the day, so... Yeah, it was pretty outstanding.
It went well. When did you arrive and who was there?
I boarded a bus here in the west end of Toronto. We shared a bus with some folks on the east side of Toronto. And we packed that bus and we drove down. We left the stop at around 9 in the morning, got to Hamilton about an hour later.
Yeah.
And when we got there, there was about 100 plus people in the welcome center there.
Okay.
And so our friends in Hamilton at the Social and Planning Research Council hosted us, and the day was coordinated by the Social Planning Network of Ontario, and so a lot of folks for that, for sure.
All right. How'd you strike up the link with the Social Planning and Research Council? They're not exactly invisible, but they are a Hamilton organization.
Well, that's a good question. I guess... I'm not sure how far it goes back now, but however we first connected, I know that Hamilton has been quite organized on the issue of poverty reduction and that they have a round table there. But the stop where I work, we launched this web-based tool called Do the Math last June.
Yeah.
And we've got a postcard that goes with it, and Hamilton's been really involved in that campaign, and so I've been in touch quite a few times over the last several months.
Oh, good. I had no idea. In what ways has Hamilton been involved in that campaign? Tell me about it.
Okay, well, let me explain the campaign first of all.
Yeah, sure.
The kind of the origins of the campaign come back from probably from 2 Junes ago. And it was a time when the current provincial government was doing their consultation process. And our community, which is one of the lower income neighborhoods in the city, was excluded, was not one of the chosen neighborhoods for consultation.
Right.
And we thought that was a shame, and so we decided to set up our own meeting, and we actually invited the chair at the time of the Poverty Reduction Committee, her name was Bill Matthews, to our community, and she, to her credit, she came down to hear from people in Davenport West. And there was a moment at the end of that meeting where there was a community member who stood up, and she was on Ontario Works at the time, and she sort of asked the minister straight up, she said, who's setting the rates for social assistance and what criteria is used to set the rates? And the moment of silence, or rather awkward moment of silence.
Right.
And, Mr. admitted at the time that there was no, that the government of Ontario does set the rates, but that they don't actually use any criteria to set the rates. They're not based on any market cost of living.
Oh.
And so we thought, this is, we already knew this in some ways, but we thought this is ridiculous. It's time that the government does the math on what it costs to live in this province, because obviously they don't know if they think that income security programs that are as little as $572 a month are enough to support people in Ontario.
Right.
So the Do the Math website asks people to consider what it costs to live in a month, not to be the most generous, not to give the most generous estimate, but a realistic estimate of the cost of living with, you know, health and dignity are our two main criteria.
Right.
And if you go through that survey of a monthly budget, you and then the web tool allows you to compare that to the actual cost of living.
Right.
And that, they don't match up very well.
No, they don't. Do you have any more accurate measure of what the projected figures people are putting in and what the actual figures that come back, how they differ?
Yeah. So on December 4th, we released our latest results. We were able to keep track somewhat of the information that people contribute. And as of December 4th, we've had 3,000 people do the survey online.
Right.
And they estimated that healthy food, that the cost of all expenses was people needed minimally $1,490 a month to pay
right.
for a living.
Right. Yeah.
More than 2.5 times the monthly income currently received by a single person on Ontario works. Right.
Yeah.
So $1,490 was the average compared to $572 currently for a single on Ontario works. I think it was $1,017 for. And the person on ODST currently.
Yeah, I don't think anybody could call $1,490 an extravagant figure either.
Not at all, eh?
No.
Anyway, so in terms of what Hamilton was doing is, part of the work we've been doing too is to actually meet with MPPs, and we've been trying our best to set up meetings with MPPs in different communities because we think that people are going to run to be a representative of a community. They should make sure that the most vulnerable people in that community have enough money to, you know, provide for themselves and their families and to contribute in a positive way to their neighborhood. And so we ask people, when we meet with MPPs, we ask them to do the math and to ask to tell us what they think it actually costs to live with health and dignity. And so I know that Hamilton was quite active in meeting with MPPs over there and getting them to actually do the math.
You had a lot of them do the math.
We've done, I think, about 25 MPP meetings to this point across the province. So, you know, local people, I don't meet with all those MPPs, but
yeah,
but people have set up those meetings.
But you mentioned in Hamilton a number of MPPs showed up.
Yeah, you guys have like 4 MPPs, I believe.
Oh, okay.
Is that right?
Well, I'd be hard pressed to do it because they keep changing the boundaries of the constituencies.
Right.
But I think of Hamilton Center, Hamilton East, Hamilton West. There are several ridings on the mountain, and then you get further east, you get into I don't think anymore. There's a separate riding for like Stony Creek. I think that's about it. And maybe half a dozen.
Yeah, so Hamilton has been pretty active over there. While I remember, I think I should give you guys the address, so if your listeners want to visit the site, they can do that, and it's www.dothemath.thestop.org.
Dothemath.thestop.org?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Much appreciated. So do you figure you were, I get the feeling that you figure you were a success in Hamilton. What kind of outcome do you hope for?
Well, you know, the reason we were going to Hamilton on December 4th was that it was the one-year anniversary of the government, of Ontario's commitment to, or the announcement of their poverty reduction plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we thought it was important to mark that day.
Yeah.
And, you know, some positive things have emerged from that. Some things have emerged from the plan, but, you know, sorely lacking has been any action on social assistance, in particular for adults on social assistance.
Yeah, I gather it took them a year to appoint people to a panel to examine poverty.
Right, and that was part of it. At the time when we planned the event in Hamilton, there was still no sign of the social assistance review that they promised a year earlier.
Yeah.
I was able to attend a couple of the consultations in Toronto that they did, and certainly the ones that I was at, people voiced their concern about, you know, how horrendous social assistance rates were. And so when the announcement came out a year ago in December, there was nothing in it really for adults on social assistance at all. And I think that they felt that they had to say something, and so they did make this commitment to review social assistance, right?
Yeah. This is a technique I'm familiar with now with this government, that they're trying to drag it out to the point where when they come to the next election, they don't have time to implement any improvements to assistance, but they can give us a promise. If we reelect them, they'll promise so-and-so and such-and-such. And I'm not feeling good about that, especially about the year delay in setting up a panel.
Yeah, that's not promising at all, right, when it takes a year just to put together a panel, right? That's a year in which I know people in our neighborhood went without a lot of things, right?
Were yeah.
Not able to get the kind of food that they needed to be healthy. People got sick, people died, from not having the things they need. And so that's quite shameful, right?
Yeah.
I think it was unfortunate that it took a year for them to begin their review.
Yeah.
Because it hasn't begun yet. They've just announced that it will begin again. and I think their cynicism is shared by people, right? But, in some ways, I think the programs need to be reviewed because they just don't work, and there's a lot of things that can be improved, right?
Yeah.
And that's part of what the Do the Math tool tells us, right?
Yeah.
So that, in fact, if there was, if they wanted to help people and make sure that people were getting access to things like healthy food, they would, in fact, take immediate steps, and that's why we asked for an immediate $100 increase.
Yeah. There's been no feedback on that, though. Not yes, not no, not we're thinking about it, nothing.
Yeah, you're right. There hasn't. I mean, there's been feedback in individual, like off the record meetings with MPPs.
Okay.
But no, we haven't heard anything officially.
Yeah, I had one. I get my dental work done in Burlington, and I had one dental assistant say in Burlington that she thought things had gotten a little better. And I didn't even ask her how. I said, no, they haven't. And she says, well, a little better. I said, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but if somebody hits you on the head every 5 minutes and then they change to hitting you on the head every 10, have things gotten better, I said, it's people like you that make sure that things will never get better. She was kind of quiet after that. But I wasn't too pleased with the upper middle class perspective of the situation of people on fixed incomes. And somehow the issue seems not to have penetrated enclaves like Burlington, Oakville, Markham. I don't know why. And yet I know there are activists in those areas who put those issues forward. What do you plan to accomplish with the Do the Math program in the coming year? You just more visits, more traveling, more expense for you to engage people face-to-face and politicians across the province, or what?
Well, I think we're trying to do a few things, right? One is to raise awareness with the general public.
Yeah.
That I think there are people, there's so much damage that's been done in terms of stigmatizing people on social assistance over the last 20 years, and that the general public, I think, really believes that people on welfare are getting generous sums of money. That is,
to the point where it discourages them from working.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anybody who does the math would have a hard time sticking to that.
Yeah.
Belief, I think.
Yeah.
And then I think, or that people aren't really going hungry because food banks, for example, are stepping in. And, food banks, they're an emergency, last resort, but they're certainly not making anybody food secure. They provide a very minimal amount of food.
You're lucky to come away from a food bank with meat of any kind. Yeah, and you and I discussed before the interview the information that I've got, but I haven't yet substantiated that food banks in Hamilton, at any rate, are qualifying people according to a newly stringent interpretation of the rules and excluding people with disabilities. I hope to do an interview on that by next week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you are going to be traveling the province in the new year? Or at least your advocates are?
But we're trying to build our network of people who are working on this campaign to put food in the budget, to ask for an immediate $100 increase of a healthy food supplement for people on social assistance, and ask. I think, one of the things we need to look forward now is that if this, as the social assistance review happens, that one piece of it, that the terms of reference have to include setting social assistance rates in a realistic way based on what it actually costs to live, right?
Well, that makes sense.
It's not acceptable that we have the social assistance review that doesn't look at benefits that reflect the real cost of living, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So there's both, for example, like in Hamilton, Ted McMeekin, you know, I think folks met with him, and, you know, he saw that $100 wasn't actually enough to add to Ontario Works and ODSP, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, part of the Liberal government. But he said he couldn't support the healthy food supplement yet because of the need to go through the proper channels, like basically through the social assistance review.
Yeah.
And, you know, so in Hamilton, you know, it's going to be important that people, you know, engage with Mr. McMeekin now and say, well, the review's on, you know.
What's on?
That's the social assistance review has been, you know, re-announced. Or that it's,
all right.
You know, and that, you know, if $100 isn't enough, I certainly agree with that.
Yeah.
But it's not okay to wait around any longer, right?
Yeah. Well, that's a good point, and maybe several people listening will pick up their mouse and search out Mr. McMeekin's email, or better yet, put pen to paper, which always makes an impression, and write him and congratulate him on his observation and ask him if he won't intervene to push the initiative forward. Are people who want to take part in your effort to attract more advocates and reach more people across the province, is there a way that they can engage with the STOP to do that?
For sure. I mean, I think the first step would be going to the DeepenMath website itself. And so that's www.dothemath.thestop.org.
Yep.
You know, this is part of the Do the Math is something we developed locally in our neighborhood. And
yeah.
Our neighborhood-based organization, and so, you know, most of our focus is on organizing here.
Yeah.
But we are one of the partners on this Put Food in the Budget campaign.
Okay.
Coordinated by the Social Planning Network of Ontario.
Okay.
And, the best thing to do really is to get involved is to contact the SPNO.
Okay.
Because we're looking for people to organize in their own communities.
All right. Right. Like you have.
Yeah, exactly.
Social Planning Network of Ontario.
But in Hamilton, I think if people are listening in Hamilton, which I assume they are, it would be good to contact the Hamilton Research and Social Planning Council.
Social Planning and Research Council in Hamilton, yeah.
Yeah.
And possibly even Deirdre Pike there.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there anything else you wanted to say before we let you get on to other things today?
No, thanks, Jeff. It's good to talk to you.
Yeah, good to talk to you and to review that progress is being made on the many fronts, both for your neighborhood, which needs it badly, and across Ontario, modeled after your efforts. I think that's exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jonah.
Okay, Jeff, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now for Disrespect's review for the weeks. In fact, since we haven't seen you since December, the month's news. Wanted: common sense for city police, from the National Post, Friday, January 15th. As has been widely reported, Dr. Michael Kutrick was pulled over by police for speeding last weekend. The doctor was traveling 75 kilometers an hour in a 40-kilometer zone, was assessed a $300 fine. What turned this traffic stop into a news story was the fact that Dr. Kutrick was rushing to St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto to perform surgery on a heart attack victim, Jeffrey Hallstrom. The ticketing cost him perhaps as many as 10 minutes. The debate is clear. Either speeding causes accidents and is inexcusable, or delaying a life-saving procedure is inexcusable. The police have stuck to the guns, arguing it's the officer's duty to enforce public safety. I spoke to Mr. Hallstrom's partner by phone. He shared the happy news that so far Mr. Hallstrom is recovering as well as could be expected. But the police's contention that speeding is a safety issue would carry more weight if it weren't so hollow. Do they seriously expect us to believe that police do not race at full speed to reports of officers in distress? Would the officer have been as eager to slow down Dr. Kutrick, reportedly telling the doctor that it doesn't matter that every second counted, if it had been a police officer with gunshot wounds waiting on the operating table rather than a civilian with a heart condition?
Mr. Oscars told me that after the shock began to fade away after the delayed surgery, rage took its place. Rage that his partner's life was pointlessly endangered, and rage that a doctor pleading to be allowed to save a life was so callously delayed. He's absolutely right. It cannot happen again. From The Spectator, Who Owns the City? By Sarah Mann. Not everyone is part of the public. We criminalize the antisocial. Few Hamiltonians are unfamiliar with phrases such as urban decay or cleaning up the streets. Many of us are rightly concerned about the rights of people living in poverty, sex workers, people experiencing homelessness in the wake of cleanup efforts. On one side of the debate, city councillors are demanding cleaner streets and a more attractive, marketable, and lucrative Hamilton. On the other side are humanitarians, activists, and social service providers arguing for universal access, human rights, and basic survival for the city's most vulnerable residents. A recent article in The Spectator raised concerns over the police's power to stop antisocial behavior. Such comments may be disguised as neutral concern for public interest, but membership in the public body is strictly limited. People who look threatening or whose behavior offends public morals are the targets of anti-loitering and similar cleanup bylaws. This means people who don't have the money it takes to look clean, people with psychiatric disabilities, youth, people whose sexualities are controversial, racialized people and Aboriginal people, people who are traditionally poorer, more visible, less likely to be consumers, who have fewer places to go and who are more likely to be called offensive. So we're talking about making people into criminals based on income, ability, sexuality, gender, and race. We're talking about removing them from wherever they call home and denying them access to necessary services. Displacing and criminalizing some people and removing them from our understanding of the public makes everyone's citizenship dependent on a willingness and ability to participate in a property and consumption-driven economy. Maybe most of us are still represented by such a system, but thousands of Hamiltonians have been and will continue to be injured by the drive for clean streets, and those of us who never lose our homes or freedoms aren't immune either. It dehumanizes us all. From The Spectator, Monday, January 25th, Deal Resolves Lawyers' Legal Aid Boycott by Katie Dobbs. Ontario lawyers have ended an 8-month boycott of the province's legal aid system, which has stalled more than 100 cases, with a 7-year agreement. The deal, which increases legal aid funding from $200 million to $280 million, means the province's poorest accused will once again have access to the legal aid system. Legal aid lawyers who top out at $90 an hour will see hourly rates rise 5% annually, reaching $136 an hour by April 2015. I'm relieved we reached an agreement and averted an escalation that would have led to a long and unpleasant standoff, said Frank Adario, the past president of the Criminal Lawyers Association, or CLA. Association members began boycotting homicide cases in June 2009 and had plans to expand the boycott today, January 25th. The dispute stemmed from pay inequity. In the past 20 years, legal aid rates increased by 15%, while Crown attorneys had raises of 57% in the past decade. Yesterday's deal saw the province agree to 3 additional years of rate increases for criminal, family, immigration, and refugee and mental health lawyers who take on legal aid cases. It's not clear what the cost of those will be, said Attorney General Chris Bentley. If there's additional cost for those tariff increases, the money would be found. Also in yesterday's deal is a promise for more funding for defense experts who are paid lower rates than Crown expert witnesses. The deal also creates a big case pay scale to attract and keep experienced lawyers. Starting in February, lawyers working on the most complicated cases will make $120 an hour, and by April 2015, $160 an hour. The rate is based on a similar program in British Columbia. Adario called the deal the longest and largest commitment Ontario has made to the legal aid program. In an email to CLA members, President Paul Burstein wrote that the association had received recognition as the voice of the legal aid defense bar. Saturday, January 16th, Globe and Mail. Linda Johnson, Trenton, New Jersey. The title, U.S. Prosecutors Allege Johnson & Johnson Paid Kickbacks. Yeah, that's right, the baby powder people. U.S. federal prosecutors allege that healthcare giant Johnson & Johnson paid tens of millions of dollars in kickbacks so nursing homes would put more patients on its blockbuster schizophrenia medicine and other drugs. In a complaint, prosecutors said J&J paid rebates and other forms of kickbacks to Omnicare Incorporated, the country's biggest dispenser of prescription drugs in nursing homes. Prosecutors allege Omnicare pharmacists then recommended that nursing home patients with signs of Alzheimer's disease be put on the powerful schizophrenia drug Risperdal, which was later found to increase the risk of death in the elderly. The allegations are in a complaint filed by the attorney in U.S. attorney in Boston, whose office has joined two whistleblower cases, one filed in 2003 by a former Omnicare pharmacist in Chicago, Bernard Lisitsa, who alleges he was fired after he alleged the Risperdal kickbacks and other improper practices. The other was filed by former Omnicare financial analyst David Kammerer in 2005 after he resigned. The complaint states that Johnson & Johnson knew Omnicare pharmacists reviewed the charts of nursing home patients at least once a month, then made recommendations to physicians on what drugs patients should be getting. And from yesterday's Spectator, 140 jobs to go as Hamilton Health Sciences cuts $17 million from its budget. Hamilton Health Sciences is cutting $17 million to balance its next budget, a move that will eliminate nearly 140 positions. The cuts will reduce some clinical services, such as elective surgeries, and mean longer wait times for patients. Hamilton Health Services operates several hospitals, including McMaster Medical Center, Hamilton General, and Henderson General. Its budget is $1 billion. We know we're not immune from the realities of the economic reality that we face as a province, HHS President and CEO Murray Martin said. And we do know it's going to mean some belt tightening for the healthcare delivery system. Where are the cuts being made? Reductions that do not affect clinical practices include consolidating services, supplying contract savings, reducing the cost of creating and managing paper charts as Hamilton Health Sciences moves toward electronic health records and more effective use of drugs. Surgical services. The hospital will perform about 1,200 fewer surgeries annually, translating into about a 5% overall reduction. These are elective. Patients seeking a hernia operation, a cosmetic procedure, or a joint replacement, for example, will have to wait longer to get into the operating room. Changes will take effect April 1st. Efficiencies were also found through consolidation of operation bookings and other means. In the end, just under $1 million in services needed to be cut. Intensive care beds, 4 will be cut at 3 hospitals. Alternate level of care beds. Across Hamilton Health Sciences, 43 beds will be cut. The hospital will close beds as patients move on to places such as nursing homes. These patients will start being placed in the next couple of weeks so system changes can be monitored prior to April 1st. HST, harmful to seniors, jobless, from letters at thespec.com. Regarding HST to give low-income earners families boost. Study, December 14th. What a boost to low-income seniors and the unemployed will the HST be? To low-income workers, another $8 a year, don't spend it all at once. And how will this be a boost to seniors who are on a fixed income and the unemployed who have to live on the less-than-minimum wage EI benefits? They all have to pay utilities each month, and the HST will be taking more money they don't have out of their pockets. This boost won't even cover the cost of 1 month's 8% extra in their heating and hydro costs, a necessity. Tax credits are once-a-year returns. What happens during the rest of the year? Income tax cuts only benefit those who are working. Seniors on fixed incomes and the unemployed won't qualify for these cuts. How are they going to benefit with the government's tax grab called the HST? Premier Dalton McGuinty needs to face the reality of what this tax grab is going to cost all those already facing hard times. This report from the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives sounds more like McGuinty propaganda aimed at making it sound like we're all going to benefit. The only ones benefiting will be big businesses, not the little guy who now has to collect another tax they didn't have to before. I'm sure at election time, the impact to our wallets will be a reminder of who to vote for, especially as the cold weather and our utility bills arrive. And the Globe and Mail, Adam Radwanski, a cynical lesson in how to make controversy go away. Handling a wrongful dismissal suit puts a dent in McGuinty's Boy Scout image. You can spend a lot of time watching Dalton McGuinty and come away convinced that he doesn't have a mean bone in his body. The Ontario Premier is about as earnest as politicians get, and even his opponents will reluctantly acknowledge his decency. But contrary to his image, McGuinty is not a Boy Scout, as an ugly little saga that concluded this holiday season demonstrated he can be pretty cynical when he needs to be. It was fitting that Kelly McDougall's firing as CEO of the Ontario Lottery and Gaming Corp seemingly ended much as it began, as a matter of cold calculation on the part of Mr. McGuinty's Liberals. It's conceivable that Mrs. McDougall's wrongful dismissal suit just happened to be settled on Christmas Eve, as officials claim, but if so, it was one hell of a coincidence. Unlike another lawsuit settled over the holidays against the province and the Ontario Provincial Police for failing to protect a Caledonia family during a native occupation, this one wasn't in the midst of court proceedings. There was no great urgency other than clearing the decks for Paul Godfrey, the Ontario Lottery Corporation's new chair. But there was considerable upside for the government in making the announcement while most Ontarians were busy wrapping presents right before the one day of the year that no major newspapers publish. If there was a surprise, it was that Ms. McDougall, who had been seeking $8.4 million, didn't get more than $750,000. After all, it was obvious from the moment last August she was unceremoniously fired with no severance pay that she would be due for a rather large payout. That was surely obvious not just to onlookers, but to Mr. McGuinty, Finance Minister Dwight Duncan, and others who made the decision to fire her, but they did so anyway, because in effect it meant paying later, with public money, to make a problem go away immediately. The problem in question was that hot on the heels of the e-health scandal, another provincial agency was about to come under fire for its expenses. Never mind, some of the expenses were probably defensible in this instance, since OLG is expected to operate largely like a private company. The government had no interest in making that case, which admittedly would have been a tricky one, so instead it preemptively fired Ms. McDougall before the story had even properly broken. No doubt opposition will be happy to remind the Liberals of that the next time an agency head or some other official gets in hot water. By firing Ms. McDougall at the first whiff of an expense scandal, the government set a standard it will come to regret when someone it considers less expendable is on the line. And in the meanwhile, it's risked a paralyzing culture of fear in government agencies and departments. It might also not do wonders for Mr. McGuinty's Boy Scout image. But that would require Ontarians to belatedly pay attention. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, January 5th. Christy Blatchford, Caledonia. The great disgraceful saga the Ontario government may have hoped to bury with its recent out-of-court settlement with Caledonia residents Dave Brown and Dana Chatwell has got new legs. That settlement, reached late last month without the government or the OPP admitting liability, saw the couple sign over their former dream home to the government in exchange for dropping their lawsuit in an undisclosed sum. Mr. Brown and Ms. Chatwell had been suing for a total of $7.5 million, claiming that they were abandoned by the OPP and the state during the continuing native occupation of the former Douglas Creek Estates housing subdivision. Their unprecedented tale of fear and distress was unfolding daily before Ontario Superior Court Judge Thomas Bielby until a surprise deal quietly was struck on December 29th. The central allegation in the aborted Brown-Chatwell lawsuit was that the OPP treated the occupation as a land claims issue and so failed to protect the couple from the lawlessness all around them. Indeed, it became clear at trial that the government was petrified of inflaming the situation that the OPP, on orders either from Queen's Park or its own senior ranks, treated the site as a no-go zone and preferred to negotiate with protesters rather than arrest them. And now we'll take a short break with Pete Johnson and the imaginatively titled Boogie Woogie. Adam Radwanski again. McGinty gearing up to take on pharmacies over generic drugs pricing. Even setting aside the death threats, it's shaping up to be among the nastiest battles Dalton McGinty's Liberals have faced. But at a time when they're scratching and clawing for every penny of savings, a fight with Ontario's pharmacies is one that many Liberals don't feel they can avoid. And it's one they think they can win in the court of public opinion. It won't be easy. Pharmacists, the folks who dole out prescriptions and offer advice on how to clear up your sinuses, are trusted. A gigantic public relations machine commissioned by pharmacies will drive home that image. The case the government will look to make is that it's not pharmacists who are the problem, it's their employers, mostly chain drugstores such as Shoppers Drug Mart and Rexall. The argument is that they're taking up an undue share of healthcare dollars and potentially impeding access to a full range of pharmaceuticals by participating in a system that gouges Ontarians on the price of generic drugs. It's on those drugs, rather than brand names, that pharmacies, not just in Ontario but across the country, make most of their money. Ideally, generics manufacturers, whose products are cheaply produced and virtually indistinguishable from the competition, would compete with each other to offer the lowest prices. But the system has evolved such that they compete by paying pharmacies large rebates to stock their products. As a result, the biggest cost to manufacturers isn't manufacturing. It's paying those rebates, the cost of which is passed along to the consumer and pushes up the price of prescriptions. In 2007, the government tried to end this, which until then involved everything from cash to free vacations, but after coming under immense pressure from an industry with very deep pockets, it settled for half measure. The drugs purchased from pharmacies on the Ontario Drug Benefit, the public plan for Ontarians on social assistance or over 65, the rebates were formalized as professional allowances and capped at 20% of the drug's price. That helped lower prices paid by government since rebates had previously been higher. But the Liberals made a major concession by not regulating the rebates or the prices for drugs sold to private plans or cash-paying customers. Helen Stevenson, the bureaucrat who's the province's point person on pharmaceuticals, told reporters that she received death threats while working on the 2007 legislation. She gives speeches with a plainclothes Ontario Provincial Police escort. While alleged threats are presumably from the fringes, they underscore how much is at stake, particularly since Ontario sets the trend for the rest of Canada on drug prices. The first time around, the Liberals yielded. Now they counter that pharmacies are thriving, chains have added stores, even during a recession. The difference in tone is attributable to the fact that unlike the days of 2007, there's a $24.7 billion deficit, and the new health minister, Deb Matthews, is charged with slowing the rise of health spending. Next to a fight with doctors or hospitals, a battle over pharmaceuticals looks inviting. The government's challenge will be to convince Ontarians that its quarrel isn't with pharmacists, but the faceless corporations they work for. Those faceless corporations will spare no effort and no expense to convince them otherwise. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, January 5th. Lisa Priest, the postal code lottery for cancer drugs. Funding for some drugs remains unequal across the country, a discrepancy that baffles victims of life-threatening illness. Bill Niblock has the same cancer as hundreds of others in Canada, but he can't obtain identical treatment. Unequal access to cancer drugs, a long-standing issue for patients and oncologists, was to be remedied with the creation of the Joint Oncology Drug Review, to which all provinces but Quebec belong. Despite JODR's formation in March 2007, the funding of some cancer drugs remains unequal across the country. But Helen Stevenson, executive officer of the Ontario Public Drug Programs, defended the JODR's effort, saying eight drugs have so far been funded by most provinces on its recommendation. However, that figure represents only a third of the total number of drugs reviewed. And when asked why some provinces fund drugs that others do not, Ms. Stevenson noted that quite often it is an affordability issue. That is certainly the issue for Mr. Niblock, 68, who can't afford the $22,000 a year price for the drug to treat his chronic lymphocytic leukemia, a blood and bone marrow disease. If he lived out west, he'd be prescribed a new drug in British Columbia, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan, and if he resided farther east, he would have a greater chance of obtaining it. Newfoundland, Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick, and Quebec all provided on a case-by-case basis. But because he lives in Hamilton, Mr. Niblock cannot obtain the drug his oncologist wants him to take, as it is under review for funding. At present, Ontario funds it for only some lymphoma patients and rheumatoid arthritis sufferers. Alberta and Nova Scotia also don't fund it, despite new data showing CLL patients live longer if they take it with chemotherapy. It seems so unfair, Mr. Niblock said. Clinical hematologist Ronan Foley said his patient, Mr. Niblock, should start on the drug within the next month or two. If he waits too long, he could become too ill to start using it. There needs to be a process to crisply determine which drug should be available based on rigorous, high-quality clinical data, said Dr. Foley, director of the Stem Cell Laboratory at Hamilton Health Sciences Center. Mr. Niblock, who will receive chemotherapy without the drug, wants to live as long as possible, as many people rely on him. His wife, daughter, and two grandchildren all live with him. Without the drug, I will fatigue away and it will overcome my system and it will kill me, Mr. Niblock said. And then it's going to cost money again to get buried. And from the Spectator Health News, one in seven Canadians lives with a disability. An aging population and growing awareness mean the number of people living with disabilities is on the rise in Canada. A new study says more people with disabilities have access to jobs and the tools and aids they need, but the wage gap between those with disabilities and those without is growing. The 2009 Federal Disability Report shows that about 4.4 million Canadians, or about one in seven, now have a disability. The analysis attributes much of the increase to the aging of the population, but also points to an increase in reported learning disabilities. About 2.5% of the country's adult population has a learning disability, compared with just 1.9% in the 2001 data. The most common types of disability are related to an aging population: pain, mobility, and agility. Spectator. Time to Transform Social Assistance by Jennifer Laidley and Deirdre Pike. Much of the system we now have, the system that should be helping to reduce and eliminate poverty, is a reflection of a divisive time when governments played up prejudices about those living in poverty, blaming and shaming people who were already down on their luck. It was a difficult time to be poor in Ontario, but with the provincial government's commitment to reduce child poverty by 25% by 2013, Ontario's poorest were beginning to hope those dark days were behind us, that things could be better. But the Auditor General's analysis of social assistance lets a dysfunctional welfare system off the hook and erroneously lays blame with the people who have nowhere else to turn for basic support. Many were disheartened by the auditor's report and the public reaction to it, but this simply highlights the urgent need for social assistance reform because the system, and not the people who rely on it, is deeply flawed. For starters, social assistance has proven that it's very good at counting the wrong things. Take its treatment of so-called overpayments. Most result from routine occurrences by any other name, a recipient getting long-awaited back pay from a previous child, a job, child support arrears, or being asked by their part-time employer to work an extra hour. Because these routine debits and adjustments are classified as overpayments, the misperception that widespread abuse exists in the system is created. The truth is, more Ontarians cheat on their income taxes and lie about their cross-border shopping than defraud the welfare system. Corporate crime, white-collar fraud, and tax evasion in Ontario are reported to cost taxpayers more every year than the entire cost of the social assistance system. It's time to stop blaming people and fix the system, a system that claws back 100% of money received from any source other than employment, forcing people to live on incomes that make it impossible to pay rent, heat a home, and put nutritious food on the table. This is a system that casts suspicion on any Ontarian drawing on legitimate special diet benefits required to meet the nutritional treatment needs of people with disabilities. This is a system that refuses the pleas of clients for supports to help them enter the job market because they don't fit into the existing patchwork of welfare rules. Given all the shortcomings that plague the system, what is most surprising is that people manage to survive despite welfare. To really understand the problems with social assistance, the Auditor General would do well to examine how feasible it is to live a healthy life given a monthly benefit rate of $585 for a single person in Ontario, works in a city such as Toronto. Never mind contemplating the pursuit of better opportunities when daily survival is such an all-consuming challenge. In the 1990s, vital supports such as social assistance were relentlessly ravaged. Employment insurance lay in tatters. Education and health care saw calamitous cuts, but the promised prosperity passed most of us by. Ontario's poor did not deserve the mean-spirited treatment following the 1990s recession, and they don't deserve it this time around either. This time around, Ontario can do better. National Post, Winnipeg, from the Winnipeg Free Press. Alcohol, cold weather blamed for death of woman found in bus shelter. Alcohol and cold weather are believed to have contributed to the death of a woman found frozen in a Winnipeg bus shelter. Winnipeg Police Constable Jacqueline Chaput said a Winnipeg transit driver spotted two bodies in a bus shelter just west of downtown around noon. The driver called police after suspecting they were the same two people he had seen in the shelter earlier in the morning. They'd been there for several hours, Constable Chaput said. The woman was pronounced dead at the scene. A man who was with her was taken to hospital in unstable condition but has since been upgraded to stable. Constable Chaput said there are no indications of foul play. And from the Globe and Mail, by Michael Kesterton. Quote, one of the hairiest moments occurred when we were almost run over by a road sweeper, which simply didn't see our small group huddled together, which just goes to show how vulnerable rough sleepers are. End quote. By Prince William, who spent a night outside in London to draw attention to the plight of the homeless. Homeless women struggle to find shelter. Spectator Denise Davey. Local services struggle to meet their needs. Homeless women are literally being left out in the cold when it comes to services and supports in Hamilton. At Mary's Place on East Avenue North, the only all-female emergency shelter in Hamilton, homeless women were turned away 1,556 times over the past year. That's almost the double the number from 2006, when women were turned away 800 times, according to a report by the Social Planning and Research Council called On Any Given Night. As a result, agencies say more women are ending up on the streets. Staff at the Out of the Cold program, which provides hot meals to the homeless, say women now make up one-third of clients. When the program started in 1997, female clients were rare. Coordinator Sister Carol Ann Gay said they've decided to reopen their overnight program because some women have nowhere else to go. Wesley Urban Ministries is the only other emergency shelter in the city that allows women, but she said many women say they aren't comfortable there. One woman told me, I don't like it here. It's someone starts screaming at night, nobody tells them to stop, Sister Carol Ann said. Wesley Director Paul Johnson said they see 10 to 12 women every night at their overnight center. Wesley also provides shelter for men, so some women may choose not to access our center for that reason, Johnson said. A new emergency shelter for women is scheduled to open in late July as part of a major complex of social services developed by Good Shepherd. Mandora Uphall, Director of Women's Services for Good Shepherd, said Mary's Place, which has 9 beds, will be replaced with a 20-bed facility that will also provide women with more assistance. However, Uphall said it still won't solve the problem. Homeless women's needs are often very different from men's. Once you're into that cycle, it's hard to change. We could open even more beds, but it won't solve the problem. The new facility will also include a new Martha House, a shelter for abused women. Sister Carol Ann said many of the homeless women she sees are struggling with a mental health problem, including a woman in her 30s who regularly comes to the Out of the Cold program for food. I thought about her this morning and was worried about where she slept last night, Sister Carol Ann said. And by Ken Peters at the Spec, city's deep freeze can kill those on the street. People can die in this weather. Those 6 words from Wesley Center Director Tom Davies provided a timely reminder that the bright skies and plummeting temperatures that resulted in Hamilton's second cold alert since New Year's Friday hold more dire consequences to some than dead batteries. Alerts are issued when temperatures are expected to nosedive below minus 15 degrees centigrade, and wind chill conditions slide to below minus 20. You can die in this weather, Davies said yesterday. It won't kill everybody, but most of our clients, their health is compromised. Davies knows one 50-year-old woman who used to spend nights outside in this kind of cold. She would bundle herself into a snowmobile suit and sleep in an abandoned car that had to be wrapped in an old carpet to keep the wind out. Davies said he doesn't need a weather forecast to know when the cold has set in. Food numbers are up a little, sleepers are up a little. There's a huge number of requests for gloves, hats, things like that. People who never used our service before stop in looking for gloves and hats. Hamilton Police Sergeant Michael Weber said, officers are advised to be on the lookout for vulnerable citizens. Anybody who appears to be homeless or in need, especially in this cold weather, or who may be standing out and about, we approach them and speak to them and assure their health and well-being. If need be, we'll drive them to a place of safety for those being out in the cold, he said. The officers know this is important. There is always someone willing to take them in. City EI roll falls below 10,000. Remains unclear whether people have found jobs or exhausted their benefits, by Steve Arnold. Wednesday, December 23rd, Hamilton Spectator. The number of people in Hamilton on unemployment insurance has dipped below 10,000 for the first time this year. Whether or not that's good news depends on how you read the numbers. New figures from StatsCan show 9,980 people were getting regular EI benefits in the city in October. That's down from September's total of 10,430 and the lowest number recorded this year, but it's still more than double the 4,820 recipients in October 2008. The local decline matched the national movement. The number of people getting regular benefits across the country dipped 0.5% from September to October. That number is still almost 62% higher than for October 2008. What isn't clear from the EI figures, however, is whether the decline is because people have found new jobs or because they've exhausted their benefits and moved on to welfare or some other form of assistance. Economist Aaron Weir of the United Steelworkers said the statistical stew doesn't make it easy to reach a real conclusion, but he suspects that the number fell because people are exhausting their benefits. Just over half of the officially unemployed, those without a job and looking for one, received EI benefits in October. In Ontario, only 40% qualify. That's the lowest benefit coverage of any province, despite having one of the country's highest unemployment rates. Canada's official unemployment rate for November stood at 8.5%. In Ontario, the official rate was 9.3%. Adding some of the people not counted by the official rate increases the national figure to 11% and Ontario's to 11.7%. That's all this week. To take us out, we have Pete Johnson and Joe Turner on vocals. Roll 'em, Pete.
You got to die someday. Well, you're so beautiful, but you got to die someday. All I want is a loving bed, get before you pass away. Roll it, boy, let them jump for joy. Yeah, man, happy as a baby boy. Well, another brand new choo-choo toy. Yeah. Baby, now you can miss me somebody else. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, yes. Yes, I know. Well, all right then. Well, all right then. Well, all right then. Well, all right then.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.